You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 13th of April 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, US President Donald Trump says America's relationship with Russia is at an all-time low, yet somehow poised on the verge of lasting peace. My guests Mary Dejewski and Kathleen Burke will be here attempting to make sense of that and discussing the day's other top stories, including President Trump's abrupt rethinking of his views on NATO and several other things besides, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad's surprise bid for a return to the presidency of Iran now that the rest of the world has descended to his level, and judging a man by his moustache in Turkey. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Mary Dejewski, columnist for The Independent and The Guardian, and Kathleen Burke, professor of modern and contemporary history at University College London. Welcome both. We will start tonight with the present state of US-Russia relations, a broad subject, given that they are, according to US President Donald Trump, both possibly at an all-time low and on the verge of lasting peace. Trump has delivered both these diagnoses within the last 24 hours, almost as if he has literally no idea what he's talking about. This follows Rex Tillerson's first visit to Russia as U.S. Secretary of State and rancor at the U.N. re-alleged Russian complicity in the recent chemical strike on the Syrian town of Khan Sheikhoun. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, meanwhile, has today said that there was no such attack, and if there was, it wasn't him, so there. Kathleen, I'll start with you first. There is obviously a lot to be going on with there. First of all, the all-time low that relations between the United States and Russia may be at. Do you want to tell Donald Trump about the Cuban Missile Crisis?
That had just leapt into my mind. I remember being in high school and I watched the whole, they sent me to a television all by myself and I watched the whole United Nations and saying, look at these pictures and so forth. Well, how many people in positions of power in this world do we know who know anything about history, you know, more than 10 years back? But it's not the lowest.
I'm not sure Donald Trump's knowledge goes further back than 10 minutes.
I said 10 years. I'll give the benefit of the doubt. No, I mean it's bad. But the thing is, you can't be too worried about it, in a sense, because the way he's been handling this, it's only going to be bad for a day or two. In fact, this was less than 24 hours.
It was indeed. Mary, a bit of historical perspective on the admittedly remote chance that President Trump is listening to us. But if you look at the United States-Russia/USSR relationship, say, since the end of World War II, has it ever been what we would think of as good?
Very rarely. I mean, what people say now, including officials both in London and in previous American administrations, is that the difference between now and then is that during the Cold War, there was quite a fixed and formal framework for relations between the then Soviet Union and the West. And looking back, people say, well, this actually made it safer in some respects than it is now, because especially over Syria, with the prospect of actually two air forces being in quite close clash territory, then there is the risk of an accident of the sort that maybe there wasn't for a lot of the Cold War. That having been said, of course, there was Korean Airlines 007,
indeed,
which created an enormous crisis. You know, I remember watching that, you know, like Kathy with the Cuban missiles, I remember watching KL 007 as it were, the world turned and you saw it happen in the Far East and gradually the impact sort of over the rest of Asia, then over Europe, then America woke up. And you thought, my God, what is going to happen now? I don't feel that same sense of risk or alarm at the moment.
Kathleen?
Well, what we also had in those early days, as it were, the post-war period that made things stable, or two things. First of all, predictability. Both sides knew there was lines, red or green or whatever, beyond which the other would not move. And I still believe that what really saved the world during that period was nuclear weapons, because people knew how appalling that would be. And again, there was a line beyond which neither would go. And I do think that we were probably felt especially after the Berlin Wall went up in 1961, when they were no longer fighting over Germany, that there was a stability. You may not like it, or you may like it, but there was a stability because each side had a good sense of what the other would take, what it wouldn't take, and how far one could go. And they just didn't go beyond that.
Mary, there was, of course, that brief period of optimism after the Soviet Union imploded in the late 80s, early 90s, of a fundamental reset. This, I guess, was Fukuyama's The End of History, a phrase I'm sure he's desperately wishes
he'd never coined.
He would have sold him a few books at the time, but man, he's never lived it down, has he? But if you look at the relationship between the United States and the rest of the former Warsaw Pact, what has stopped the United States' relationship with Russia being like its relationship is now with, you know, Poland or Hungary or the Czech Republic or Estonia?
Well, I think there's one word, actually, which is NATO, which is the continuation of NATO after the end of the Cold War. I've just finished reviewing a book by Michael Mandelbaum, who was an aide to President Clinton, and he describes the decision not to disband NATO and to expand it into Eastern Europe, in some places right up to Russia's border, as being the greatest geopolitical mistake of the last 20 years, if not the whole of the post-war period. And I tend to agree with that. I think it was a catastrophic mistake. There were all sorts of reasons why it happened, some of them sympathetic, some of them less so. But the fact is that left to the Russians an instrument of the Cold War that it has never seen any differently, and it doesn't believe that the West has seen it any differently either.
You could, of course, always have just freaked the Russians out by inviting them to join as well.
Well, there was that project, and there was a suggestion that they might, but then all that fell to pieces very quickly.
We should look, Kathleen, quickly at President Assad of Syria's interview that he's given today to AFP, I think. He has described the chemical attack on Khan Shaykhun as a 100% fabrication. Are we buying his denials at all?
Oh, I don't think so. Of course we're not. It depends on whose military intelligence you prefer to believe. But he's not going to say, yes, I'm sorry I did it, and I really am sorry about those kids foaming at the mouth, is he?
He didn't last time this happened, no.
Well, indeed. So, no, I don't think so. Those who believe him, and those who don't, and that's the end of it.
Mary, just a final thought on this before we move on somewhat. Looking back, I guess, at this week's meeting between Rex Tillerson and Sergei Lavrov, and later between Rex Tillerson and Vladimir Putin, and the way that the United States has fairly seriously suggested that they're not terrifically interested in the continuation of the Assad clan's rule of Syria. Is that actually a huge difference between Russia and the United States? As long as Russia has what it wants in Syria, does it actually care one way or the other about Bashar al-Assad?
Well, my view is that the only reason that Russia cares about Bashar al-Assad is nothing to do with any sort of personal relationship, anything to do with a Russia-Syria alliance. It's to do with the stability and the unity of Syria. And at the moment, Russia sees Assad as the only thing really that stands between Syria and even greater chaos than there currently is. And one of the things that I was very interested about in the Tillerson press conference with Sergei Lavrov, the Russian foreign ministry, there were certain signs of, if not compromise, then at least slightly different language on the American side. I mean, for the last 2 weeks or so, there's been huge confusion with mixed signals coming out of Washington as to whether they were going back to the state about a year ago, where they were demanding the departure of Assad as a precondition for anything else that might happen in Syria. And what Tillerson said in Moscow was that basically there would be an end. He was envisaging an end, as it put it, to the reign of the Assad family. But that the timetable for that and the way it happened wasn't sort of fixed. And it seems to me that there's the same room for negotiation there as there was when Kerry and Lavrov had their relationship and their long series of talks. There is room for cooperation there. But I also think that the new administration, maybe more than the last one, overestimates the amount of leverage that Putin and Russia can put on Assad. He's not nearly as tractable as I think outsiders tend to think.
Okay, well, let's move on slightly, but to a semi-related story, which is President Donald Trump's apparent reversal on the subject of NATO. Now, granted, it is only lunchtime in Washington and anything could happen before Trump departs for what would be his first vacation in Florida in several days. But as of yesterday's meeting with NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg at the White House, Trump is a born-again fan of the alliance, explaining that he regarded it as no longer obsolete. Kathleen, do we have the remotest idea what has brought about this vault face?
He talked to Stoltenberg.
I keep thinking of that old joke. I think it was told about Nicholas II, that the two most powerful men in Russia were the Tsar and whoever was the last person to speak to him.
Well, Ronald Reagan had something of that reputation as well, in fact. I think Trump is getting a crash course in international politics. And I think he's realizing that the cat that walks by himself doesn't necessarily always win the battle. It's better to have allies. It's better to have allies who are well-armed, of course, and he's not going to forget that they ought to be spending a bit more. Footnote here, Germany is going to be interesting because Angela Merkel has said that they will up to 2%, and Scholz, the SPD chairman, says no, 1.2% is quite enough. So it'll be interesting to see what Germany does, because there's certainly conflicting signals coming out that way. But yes, I mean, Trump, he's now getting not only signals, he's now getting input from other countries. And I think when he looks at what's happened in Estonia and so forth, he's going to think that, well, it's better. I'm going around in circles here. My point is, he now has realized that there's more than one country in the world, and things can happen on edges, and things aren't necessarily always big. They're sometimes small, and it's better to have a range of countries and a range of approaches and a range of areas who ideally can be mobilized by you, but that can carry out different tasks.
Mary, in another apparent sort of signal of interest in NATO, he did sign a treaty this week paving the way for Montenegro's accession to the alliance. Between that and his declaration that it is no longer obsolete, how reassured should the rest of the alliance be? Does everyone now exhale a massive sigh of relief, or does everybody, you know, brace himself to get talked out of it by a waiter at Mar-a-Lago sometime this evening and to change his mind again tomorrow?
Well, I think the latter more than the former, because, I mean, I remember, what was it, about a month or so ago, Munich Security Conference, Trump sent two of his very senior cabinet people to the security conference basically to make all sorts of reassuring noises about NATO. But the problem was that because Trump was sitting back in Washington and because he'd been saying rather different things, the actual authority that those people carried left great doubts in the minds of the people they were talking to. I'd also just like to come back on one thing that Cathy said, that Trump was sort of maybe learning some lessons from reality. And I think maybe also some of the rest of the world is sort of learning how to deal with Trump in a way that they didn't before. And I think one of the really interesting things about the Stoltenberg visit was that, in a way, he gave Trump two of the things that he wanted, at least in words. You know, he was talking about, yes, the Europeans have got to do much more. Yes, they've got to go up to 2% of GDP. And at the same time, he said, yes, you know, the priority for our alliance is the fight against terrorism. Well, you know, that was actually the big point that Trump was making when he said during the campaign that he thought that NATO was obsolete, because he said that NATO hadn't adapted to the new reality where the big enemy was terrorism. So Stoltenberg comes in and says, right, you know, we're going to fight terrorism, which of course is absolute music to Trump's ears. So I think there is a sense in which, you know, not only is Trump getting used to the world, but the world is getting used to how to deal with Putin. The world is getting used to dealing with Trump.
mean the sort of key word to use?
Yes.
Flashcards, possibly.
No, a small thing here that strikes me, the historian coming out again. Back in the olden days, around about 1950, when Dean Acheson, the then Secretary of State, said what are the important American areas, and he left out Korea, which meant that it was felt to be safe to attack Korea. I do slightly wonder about places like Montenegro coming in, because there's such a huge group of nations in NATO now. Will it be thought that if they're not NATO, they can be fair game?
Yeah, I mean, this is why I think, especially in the last couple of years, as Russia has become somewhat more muscular, this conversation has been had in Finland in particular. But again, it is that question of which, and this is the line that Finland has always walked between thinking, are we safer in NATO or are we safer not annoying Russia by joining NATO? Just a final thought from you, Mary. Are we seeing that pattern that you and Kathleen have been divining here of the world learning how to deal with Trump? Because the other thing that Trump has admitted this week was that he discovered from having spoken to the paramount leader of the People's Republic of China that apparently relationship between China and North Korea is quite complicated.
Yes, well, you know, we're sort of grateful for these insights, really. And all you can do is just sort of sit back and wait. But, you know, I remember there was huge condescension in Europe when George W. Bush took over, because the impression gained through the campaign was that he was a complete ignoramus as far as foreign affairs went, that his sense of geography was distinctly hazy. Now, I mean, I think that Trump's sense of geography might actually be rather better, because he's travelled the world, but in a rather different capacity from that as diplomat.
I just keep getting these visions of Xi Jinping sort of moving forks and spoons around the table at Mar-a-Lago, saying, you know, this cake is North Korea and this flan is China, and this is how the world now apparently actually works. On that happy thought, we will take a short break now. You are listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, along with Mary Dajewski and Kathleen Burke. Coming up next, just to add to the excitement, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad may be making a comeback.
Monocle's dedicated network of international bureau and correspondents bring the best global stories to our readers and listeners. Our eagle-eyed team of editors and journalists staffing bureau in Toronto, New York, Zurich, Istanbul, Singapore, Hong Kong, and Tokyo deliver the best content from the world's most important regions straight to the airwaves of Monocle 24 and the pages of Monocle magazine. We've also got boots on the ground in more than 30 cities worldwide thanks to our comprehensive correspondent network. It's for this reason Monocle brings an up-to-date, informed and engaging commentary from Brasilia to Brussels and from Sydney to Singapore. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
You're back with Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Mary Dajewski and Kathleen Burke. And let's look now at Iran, a country which was electing charmless, belligerent populists to its presidency long before it became fashionable. And now that the world has caught up with Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, the Islamic Republic's president between 2005 and 2013, it appears that he wants his old job back. He has registered to stand in next month's presidential election despite a stern warning off from Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, who said such a run would not be in the national interest, or perhaps more pertinently, in Ahmadinejad's. Mary, Ahmadinejad said that he regarded Khamenei's warning as just advice. Is that wise, do you think? I would listen to any advice I received from Ayatollah Khamenei fairly seriously.
No, I would agree with you absolutely, but I think that everything we know about Ahmadinejad suggests that to give him advice is actually to invite him to do precisely the opposite, especially if he's obviously made this decision that, for whatever reason, he wants to stand for president. And I have to say, when I saw that news, I thought that he sort of left the course of history a very, very long time ago. In fact, it's only about 4 or 5 years, but
about what the last 4 or 5 years have been like.
Yes,
it?
But it seems like a real relic of sort of way back. And then you think, you know, the second thing you start to think is, oh my goodness, this is an absolute gift to Donald Trump, if we go back to where we were before, because he has been much more suspicious of Iran, much less keen on cooperating with Iran. All we need is Ahmadinejad back in the political picture in Iran, and Trump looks justified.
And my Australian passport all of a sudden looks even more valuable. Kathleen, what is the more significant development here? Is it Ahmadinejad saying he wants to run? There is, of course, absolutely no guarantee he will win. And I, with all due respect to Iran's democracy, I rather get the impression that if the Ayatollah Ali Khamenei decides he definitely doesn't want you to win, then you're probably not going to. But is it more significant that he's running or that he is defying the Ayatollah to do this?
Well, I think possibly, well, you can't tear them apart, can you? I mean, the interesting thing is that he says he's running along with a mate and that he's just there going to support him. So on the grounds that if the supreme leader knocks him out, he'll have someone there who can actually be in his place. I think what they're worried about is splitting the opposition or splitting the pro-regime group, because Rouhani is still there. They want to get rid of him. If they divide the state group, one might say, in two, it's just possible that Rouhani will get back in again, and they really don't want that. So the fact that they say he can't do it, I'm not sure it's so much that they hate him, although he did fight, did he not? He was in some conflict with the supreme leader at his time then. But I think it's pure politics. They're afraid he'll split the vote.
Mary, is Iran, or could you look at Iran and see certain conditions there that would suggest that it is ripe for a populist nationalist insurrection? It has a large population, many of whom are extremely disaffected with the way things are, not altogether without reason. Whatever economic benefits may redound from the nuclear deal have not really yet had time to flow downwards to the people who have been deprived for these last many years. If you get somebody like Ahmadinejad, who I'm sure has been a keen student of the way that politics have gone in the Western world over the last few years, basically wheeling that playbook out again, it's not that unlikely a scenario, is it? I mean, that's assuming that, you know, the Ayatollah Khamenei doesn't take an extremely close interest in how the votes are counted.
No, I mean, I accept that there's probably a lot of reason for your arguments, but I'm not sure that I actually agree with that, because I think in some ways the events of the last sort of 40 years have possibly inoculated Iranians against that sort of populism all over again. I'm not convinced that they're really in for that. And Ahmadinejad won elections in the past. But I think when you look at the last sort of 5 years or so, then I think what you have in Iran is you've actually got a very sophisticated electorate. And you've also got, if something quite a lot short of democracy and democratic system, you have both a process and voters where there are opportunities to express. And I think that the responses to the last two elections from different bits of the opposition showing very imaginative type of protests and actually wielding some influence on the way things worked out, if not the actual result and who got in. I think that we may be, in a way, underestimating Iranian voters if we think that, in a way, they'll fall for it all over again.
But if I can ask a question. I mean, the thing is that the electorate is quite young. Now, that can work two ways, can't it? It can either work because they're keen on lively debate and activity and so forth, or they can look at Ahmadinejad and the others and think, these old men, you know, they've done it before. Why do we need to have them again?
Yes.
So the age of the electorate, I think, is at this point an unknown quantity. And there's such a huge percentage. They're at 40%, 50% under the age of 25 in Iran.
I mean, Mary, just a final thought on this, though. Is Ahmadinejad an especially annoying presence to the Ayatollahs because he is such a big name? Can they actually realistically forbid him from running?
I think they'll probably try and do it as they've tried to do it by persuading him that it's not a good idea and finding some sort of mechanism that makes it impossible without actually banning him per se. But it is quite, when you look at it, it's quite a standoff, isn't it? With the Ayatollahs on one side and Ahmadinejad on the other side. And if you then envisage, you know, the Americans looking on from where they're looking on from, then, you really rather want the drama to continue.
Alternatively, not. But finally tonight, in what has been a bit of a bellicose populist-themed edition of Midori House, to Turkey, where observers of the country's politics have detected a tonsorial trend upon the upper lips of male members of the cabinet of President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Specifically, moustaches very much like that sported by the president, who this weekend will seek expanded powers in a referendum. Kathleen, if he loses this referendum, is that going to be good news for Ankara as razor salesmen and barbers? Will the moustache suddenly become unfashionable again?
Probably not, because there'll be all sorts of people who support Erdogan who'll be incredibly angry, and they'll probably show their support by growing even more moustaches.
Because there is a pattern has been detected. It has been noticed that a year ago, more than half the cabinet were clean-shaven, and now only three don't have moustaches, one of whom has the excuse of being a woman. Mary, what does that tell us, apart from the fact that gender balance in Erdogan's cabinet does leave rather a lot to be desired?
Well, I think it's an appalling comment on conformity, really. Mm. And the idea to the desire to be in the group and to feel that you're not in the group if you're not sort of following the leader. I wonder whether is it a trend that came after the attempted coup, that people feel that they're somehow in danger if they don't show their solidarity?
There is apparently a whole moustache code in Turkey. I have been reading up on this. Apparently, the nationalists favour long, downward pointing ones. The leftists favour the more bushy ones, whereas conservatives like Erdogan go for the tidily trimmed one. And of course, your religious types do the beard as well. Because this is not a code we have recourse to in the West, is it, Kathleen? Because again, I have checked. There has not been a moustachioed British Prime Minister since Harold Macmillan. The last US president was Taft, and in Australia, we have not had a Prime Minister with a moustache since Billy Hughes.
Well, moustaches can be quite messy. It's difficult to kiss them if you're a female because it's bristly and it can hurt. Your soup gets caught in it. and if you don't actually shave them or keep them trimmed, they look quite appalling very soon, I think.
Have you done the same checks on beards as on moustaches? Because, of course, if Jeremy Corbyn's star suddenly rises, we might have a prime minister with a beard.
Yeah, and alternatively, we very much might not. The last bearded British Prime Minister, and I do know this without looking it up because I am that sad, was Lord Salisbury. It has been a while. The last bearded US president?
Rutherford B. Hayes?
No. How long ago was that? Grant, was he after Hayes?
Grant? No, Hayes was, it was 1877, wasn't it?
Okay. So, but it's been a while. Last Australian Prime Minister with a beard, I think, might have been Deakin, who was our second Prime Minister. It has been a while. Do either of you have a particular favourite political moustache from history? It's a good thing Ken Livingstone's not here for this question.
how far back can one go? Theodore Roosevelt was rather good, only his was a bit grayer, rather like Anthony Eden's, thick and luxuriant, but not messy.
It was an exemplary moustache, Teddy Roosevelt's, Mary.
I bow to the historians on this, and I will just slightly change the theme by saying that I'm very, very worried that what's going to happen in the British cabinet is that the female members of the cabinet are going to start wearing Theresa May hairstyles.
Oh, my God.
So I rather hope that the conformity ends with Turkey.
Well, on that happy thought, Mary Dajewski and Kathleen Burke, thank you both very much for joining us at Midori House. That is all we have time for on today's edition. It was produced by Carlotta Ribello, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Helena Jarit. Our studio manager was Kieran Banerjee. There's more music next. There's more on the day's main stories on the Daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. For now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening.